This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, dolphins are dying. Under stress, they start burning some of their blubber, which contains PCBs that have been in their bodies for years. Attorney Jan Schlichtman, who represented the families in the case which was the subject of the movie Civil Action, says lawsuits are not a good way to resolve environmental disputes. We continue our series on the origins of life. Iron, formed by an exploding, dying star, is in your bloodstream. And on the Earth calendar, lambs are being born as we broadcast. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. From Canada to New Zealand, countries across the globe are dealing with a problem of bichlorinated biphenyls. PCBs are very stable industrial compounds that were used to make all sorts of things, like the transformers found on telephone poles. Even though they've been banned in many countries, PCBs do not break down easily. They're difficult to clean up and remain in our environment for a long time. They also can be highly toxic and cause birth defects as well as other health problems. As Stephen Westcott reports, a scientist in Texas believes PCBs may be killing some marine mammals.
In 1990, 10 bottlenose dolphins beached themselves and died on the shores of Matagorda Bay in Texas. Dolphins beach themselves if they are dying because they need air to breathe and would otherwise drown. Experts weren't able to determine the immediate cause of death at first. Blubber samples were then shipped to the College of Veterinary Medicine at Texas A&M University. Dr. David Busby, professor of genetics and toxicology, performed tests other researchers had not and found non-ortho coplanar PCBs.
While they're present at low concentrations, they are among the most toxic of the 209 different forms of PCBs. And so there's not very much of it, but what's there is really important.
Dr. Busby believes the dolphins acquired the toxic PCBs from mullets and other fish, and possibly shrimp or crabs.
The polychlorinated biphenyls and other similar compounds are adsorbed onto tiny organic particles, and those are ingested by little organisms, and the little organisms are ingested by bigger organisms. And this goes right up the line until you get to the top of the food chain. And the animals like the dolphins, for instance, or humans, are at the top of the food chain.
In addition, Busby believes young dolphins are acquiring PCBs at a young age directly through mother's milk. Once absorbed into the system, PCBs will remain in the fatty tissues of animals. Even though they are highly toxic, Busby does not believe it was the PCBs alone that killed the dolphins. That particular year, cold weather and a scarcity of food were putting a strain on bottlenose dolphins. Dr. Busby believes that when the animals became sick and weak, their bodies began using up blubber to help keep them alive, blubber that contained low levels of highly toxic PCBs.
They had spent an entire lifetime bioaccumulating these compounds, and they may never have been exposed to a pharmacologically effective circulating level of PCBs in their blood until they went into this fasting mode. So when their food supply was compromised and they began to starve, they probably would have survived, or potentially anyway, could have survived, had they not utilized their blubber and in the process released very high concentrations of the chemicals into the serum.
Despite claims by some companies that PCBs are not harmful, Dr. Busby says scientific evidence shows they can be extremely toxic and can damage immune systems depending on the levels and toxicity. Besides the toxic effects PCBs are potentially having on marine life and humans, Dr. Busby is among the growing number of scientists who believe that many chemicals now polluting oceans and fresh waterways are acting as endocrine disruptors, compounds that damage hormonal systems.
These pollutants that mimic steroid hormones Some of these are estrogenic. Some of them are anti-estrogenic. Some are androgenic. That is, some of them mimic male sex hormones. Some of them are anti-androgenic. And if you look at all the systems that we know exist, look at the things that are regulated by adrenal cortex hormones, by the glucocorticoids, by testosterones and estrogens, by vitamin D, retinoic acid. All of these compounds have environmental pollutants that can mimic their action.
Dr. Busby says when these environmental pollutants begin to mimic gene regulation, enormous problems can occur. He describes the situation as very serious. Scientists around the world are documenting cases that point to endocrine disruption, such as polar bears born with both male and female sex organs, and amphibians developing with five legs or no eyes. Meanwhile, Dr. Busby says his research with dolphins is continuing, and he believes scientists will be investigating the environmental and health problems caused by PCBs and other pollutants for many years after he is retired. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
A lawyer portrayed in a recent movie is criticizing the American legal system. Jan Schlichtman gained notoriety after representing six families in a civil lawsuit in 1982. Woburn, Massachusetts residents believed contaminated drinking water caused their children to develop leukemia. The long, drawn-out battle was eventually settled out of court, but it also changed the way Schlichtman views personal injury and lawsuits. Sean Dudley has the story.
A Hollywood version of Schlichtman's story is being told in A Civil Action, a film starring John Travolta, based on a Jonathan Harb best-selling novel. Nearly 17 years after Schlichtman first filed suit in the Woburn, Massachusetts case that made him famous, he's making the rounds on the lecture circuit as A Civil Action plays in theaters around the country. Schlichtman says the Woburn case changed his mind about the role of litigation in the resolution of environmental conflicts. Now he's promoting a process of open negotiation and mediation for environmental liability cases, and his message is decidedly anti-litigation.
Litigation does not solve problems. Litigation is calculated to make the problem worse. It creates its own whole new set of problems to be the excuse not to deal with the original problem that gave rise to the litigation. And that's the basic problem with our civil justice system. You know, it's more system than civil or just. What happens when you fight is that you stake out a position and then you invest in that position economically, politically, socially, personally. And once you invest in it, then you have to demonize the other side. Say, oh, I'm right and you're wrong. And there's no room there for compromise. There's no room for accommodation. There's no room for being honest with each other because it's us or them. That's the nature of litigation. That's the nature of conflict. One side's going to win, one side's going to lose. And that's not conducive to truth determining or truth finding.
After 7 years of bitter legal wrangling in the Woburn, Massachusetts case, Schlichtman came to the conclusion that ultimately a courtroom battle offers little satisfaction to any of the parties involved.
You know, I believe if anyone loses, we all lose, because really in the end, especially when you're dealing with the environment, it involves all of us, government, industry, communities. And if anyone thinks that you can have a world that's only government or only industry or only community, you know, they ain't in the real world. The real world involves all of those basic structures and, of course, a lot of complexities in between. I find that people do things when they want to and they don't when they don't. And all of the lawsuits in the world and all the kind of imposing, you know, trying to impose your will on the other, you know, is a lot of work for very little gain.
Schlichtman says the best alternative to litigation is environmental mediation. One difference between mediation and litigation is that in mediation, all of the parties or stakeholders affected by the problem come to the same table at the same time, regardless of their legal standing. He points to mediated settlements in Toms River, New Jersey, and Groton, Mass., as examples of fair agreements reached without costly or prolonged litigation. In Toms River, the stakeholders agreed to an 18-month holding period, during which no legal action would be taken, yet the rights for future litigation were preserved. Schlichtman says this agreement allowed all the parties to negotiate from a position of relative safety. Schlickman also brokered a similar deal in Groton, Massachusetts, where chemical solvents leaking from a nearby industrial plant were suspected of causing learning disabilities in local school children.
And as a result of the partnership, the town was reimbursed its response costs, the community got a property protection and a health security fund, all negotiated items, and the everyone got a cleanup plan on the front end, a first-class cleanup plan that allowed for the sites to be cleaned up and removed them as a source of contamination to the community. The company got a partner, the community as a partner, to deal with the regulators, and therefore they got certainty and they got reasonableness and they got it in record time. And so they could go about, you know, going back to the business that they do well, which is making things.
Although a large number of environmental lawsuits are filed each year, many end in negotiated settlements. Jeff Miller teaches environmental law at the Pace Law School. He estimates that 80% of all cases end this way. However, Miller says the threat of litigation is essential in most cases to ensure cooperation.
You can't mediate anything or negotiate anything unless you have another alternative if there's no agreement reached. Usually that other alternative is litigation, so that you have a threat that you can get something out of the other side if it doesn't sit down and mediate or negotiate with you.
And statutes of limitations can further complicate negotiations, according to Miller.
If you don't file a complaint before the statute of limitations runs out, you've lost your cause of action. And if you've lost your cause of action, nobody's going to mediate or negotiate with you. You have to be aware of the statute of limitations, and that may shrink the time that's available for negotiation. Or it may cause you to file a complaint while you are negotiating.
But Schlickman maintains that an open process of negotiating environmental problems is possible and necessary. He says there are ways around the legal difficulties, and compromise is the key to quick response and cleanup in most cases. He also admits he's preaching the gospel of mediation, a lesson he says he learned after years of arguing the Woburn case.
All right, I am preaching gospel. It's true. It's very much like that. But my concern is that we don't really have time left to fight over it. You know, we really run out of time. So the quickest way to get to the resolution, I have, believe and come to realize, is that when you take the waste out, then you have the greatest chance of the problem getting solved. So take the waste of time and money and people, take that out, and that's fighting. Fighting creates that kind of waste. So if you don't fight, then you have a chance, you know, in a setting in which you're talking to each other, it's respectful, there are honest, you know, there are disagreements, there are challenges, whatever it is, but we're all going to work together to figure it out. Then a dynamic sets in which, you know, the problem gets worked on and solutions come, and actually they get employed, and they're done with the least amount of waste of time and money and people. And we can't afford to waste those things.
Jan Schlickman continues to practice environmental law, at the same time offering advice to audiences around the country. He says although mediation is a difficult process, with no guarantee of success, he believes it's the best tool available to communities dealing with environmental disputes. For the Environment Show, I'm Sean Dudley.
Eastern part of the city, Wells G&H, because the community was thriving. And then it was in this dark day.
Coverage of the origins of life is made possible by NASA through support for the New York Center for Studies of the Origins of Life. It's located at the New York State University at Albany, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the College of St. Rose. The Environment Show is a national production, and it's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com. www.environmentalmedia.com/envshow. When you get there, click on Listen to the Environment Show. In the quest for knowledge about the origins of life, scientists are finding the building blocks of life in places you may never have thought of. In our continuing series of conversations about how and where life began, Dr. Jim Napolitano, Associate Professor of Physics at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, tells us about his research relating to the subatomic particles that make up our bodies.
My research tries to understand as much as possible what matter looks like at the smallest levels and how things are put together. And it turns out that that is particularly related to what makes up our bodies, where the elements came from, and how they were cooked in stars to become what we are today.
Now, that implies that what we are required a star to cook some of these elements. How does that work?
Absolutely. The cooking processes that do this work not so much on the chemical elements, but on the nuclei deep inside the atoms. And to do this cooking requires enormous pressures, enormous temperatures. And the only place that we know that this is possible is in the centers of stars, both in their normal lifetime, but also in their deaths, which can be very spectacular. In fact, as it seems, most of what makes us up came from the deaths of stars in various forms.
And does that mean that it reached us through asteroids and other things that float through space?
That's my understanding. What we do know is that when we look at the materials that make up ourselves and make up our solar system, we can compare that to what we see being cooked in stars, and the correlations are very striking. So we believe that's where they come from.
Now, for those of us who have not been inside stars, tell me about this cooking process.
The inside of a star is a very special place. Stars are very, very massive, an enormous amount of matter, and it's basically a big ball of gas. And the only reason that big ball of gas doesn't blow away is because gravity forces the pressure to be very dense and squeeze everything down tight. So the temperature in the center of our sun is on the order of 15 million degrees, and this is enough, it turns out, to create nuclear reactions that start this cooking process.
And so what are the elements that are involved, and how did they then get translated into life as we think of it?
Excellent question. Most of the light that we see coming from our sun comes from a relatively simple process where hydrogen is burned into helium. That's interesting, and it's important that we understand that, but in fact, our bodies are not made up of helium that comes out of this cooking process. It's when our sun starts to die that the helium will turn itself into carbon, which of course is necessary for our bodies.
So how does helium get converted into hydrogen and carbon?
That's a great question. It's one of the most interesting things about this business. When a star like our sun begins to die, which will happen for our sun in about 5 billion years, the center, the fuel, the hydrogen fuel disappears in the center, and the sun, the star like our sun, will start to have its center contract. As the center contracts, it gets much, much hotter. And then something absolutely amazing happens. Helium can then get burnt into carbon. Three helium nuclei come together and form the carbon nucleus and carbon atoms, and this carbon forms seeds for oxygen, which is where this stuff actually gets produced. So that's how we get carbon and oxygen, and it combines with the original hydrogen to make things like water and carbohydrates and so forth.
Now, is that happening in our sun now, or is our sun too young for that?
Our sun is too young for that, but if you look up in the sky about this time of year, you'll see the constellation Orion, and in Orion, the upper left shoulder of Orion is a red star. If you look on a clear night, you can see that that star is red. The star is called Betelgeuse. It's the brightest or one of the brightest stars in the constellation. That's like our sun, or what our sun will be in about 5 billion years. And in the center of that star, helium is being turned into carbon, the raw materials for life.
So these raw materials for life, carbon and so on, are formed in this process of a star's death, as I understand it, and then basically are shipped out in rock and stuff that flies around.
Basically, yes, but there's a very interesting recycling process that's very important. To make elements that we need in our bodies beyond carbon and oxygen, we need to have had things like our sun built from previous deaths of stars. For example, we all know that in your blood is red because it's got hemoglobin in it, and there's iron in that hemoglobin. Everybody knows when people get old, they need more iron in their blood. So iron is a very important element. Iron is not formed in a star like our sun. It never will be formed in a star like our sun. But nevertheless, our bodies have iron in them. So where did that come from? Iron is a very special nucleus. It is in some sense one of the most stable nuclei that we know of. And that is where nuclear reactions stop, in a large sense. And we know that in supernova explosions, they end with iron, basically. And that iron was part of a supernova explosion, was spread out into space, and then swept up in the processes that gave birth to our sun and the solar system, and ultimately to us.
That was Dr. Jim Napolitano, Associate Professor of Physics at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. And now it's time for the Earth calendar. As we speak, lambs are being born on sheep farms across the northern third of the country. Lila Burley, who happens to be my spouse, has one of the largest groups of sheep in Massachusetts. We caught up with her in the middle of her flock. So what's the lamb crop been like?
Excellent. Too many triplets, basically.
And when did they start coming this year?
January 7th.
And how long will they keep coming?
Well, we have some that we had a warm spell last fall, so that we've had a stretch here now that it's been relatively slow. But when you get 15 or 16 a day, that's a lot of work.
And they'll keep going until about when?
The 1-year-olds will be lambing right through April.
Most of the lambs are born in or near big open barns where sheep come and go. But sometimes complications arise that the shepherdess must solve.
I go in and try and straighten them out and get the two front legs and a head in the right position, and then pull them. And we've been quite successful at that. Quite often a head will get bent, or one foot won't be forward, and we've had we have over 300 live lambs right now, and I would say only 3 of those were breech, which is a pretty good ratio. But we did have quite a few heads back, and that's more of a problem. You have to go way in and straighten it out and get it in the birth canal.
Shortly after lambing, the ewes require some attention.
First, we make sure that the mother's milk ducts are open. And sometimes they really are plugged, and then the lamb dies. So you really have to do that. Once the lamb has nursed, you really forget about them for a couple of days. You take very good care of the mother in a lambing, what we call jug, which is about 5 feet square. And that way the mother and the lamb talk to each other and imprint. After that, they go into what we call a halfway house, where there are a few mothers with their lambs. They sort out each other by voice and smell. We tend to get rid of animals that are problem mothers. That seems a little cold-hearted, but the fact is that we are trying to have animals at this farm that survive as healthily as possible with no human interference. And that means we don't use antibiotics, we don't use additives of any kind, we put all the manure back on the fields, and we really try to keep the farm as all natural as possible.
A pen in one corner of the barn has about 15 young lambs who are by themselves. They jump around and play and don't seem fazed by the fact that they're orphans, lambs that were either rejected by their mothers or whose mothers died. For the first few weeks, they're fed by hand from bottles. Like most critters, lamb and sheep are vulnerable to natural predators, specifically coyotes, which can be seen almost daily on the periphery of the farm. This flock is protected by two large white Maremma dogs, weighing over 100 pounds. They live among the sheep, but do not herd them. Their job is to keep other canines away.
We wouldn't be able to have any sheep here at all without the dogs that you hear in the background. These dogs are from northern Italy, and when they are in the pasture with the sheep, we lose no lambs or ewes.
That was Lila Burley in the middle of lambing season on our farm in western Massachusetts. She can tell you everything about lambs that got left out of the nursery rhyme. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we look at oil spills and their impact. In Rhode Island, lobsters are dying out, but one restoration project seeks to reverse the damage of an old spill and create new habitat. In Alaska, it's the 10th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. What has happened to the wild creatures that were poisoned, and what has been done to prevent another disaster? We talk green with people on the scene. Author David Quammen looks for coyotes in Los Angeles. These canines probably live on garbage instead of sheep. Stay with us. The Department of Environmental Management in Rhode Island says it plans to limit the number of lobster traps fishermen place within 3 miles of shore. Beginning June 1st, lobster fishermen will be limited to 1,200 traps. Next year, it will drop to 1,000 and to 800 in 2001. The move is part of a much larger effort to increase lobster populations in New England that have been dropping because of a number of forces. Part of that effort includes an experimental restoration plan designed to help the struggling species and maintain the livelihoods of fishermen. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA, and the University of Rhode Island have teamed up to try to improve lobster populations in Narragansett Bay. Last year was the first year that young lobsters raised at a hatchery at the university were released into the wild.
The novelty of this project is that we are tagging these animals with microwire tags so that you can actually, when you catch them again, you can detect whether or not they were hatchery reared or not. That's one of the biggest breakthroughs.
That's Kathleen Castro, research associate in the Fisheries, Animal, and Veterinary Science Department at the University of Rhode Island. About 3,000 juvenile lobsters were released last year. The same amount is expected to be introduced later this year. Lobster hatcheries are nothing new in the United States. But what makes this program unique is that it is one of the first times scientists will be able to see whether lobsters raised in a hatchery survive after being released. The second part of the experimental program is that the lobsters are being released into artificial habitats, according to Kathleen Castro.
What we've done is we've taken an area that has no lobsters. It's an area with a soft bottom. It's called Dutch Harbor. And we've added... We made six reefs, artificial reefs, out of quarry rock, so they came from land. And they were put into the water very carefully. Basically, each reef consists of two different parts. One part is made up of small cobble, and the other part is made up of large boulders.
Smaller rocks provide habitat for younger, smaller lobsters as well as other animals. As the lobsters grow older and larger, scientists believe they will move to reefs made from the bigger rocks. Overall, the experiment will give researchers more information on lobster development and whether man-made habitats can be successful. So far, local lobstermen are cooperating with the program and not setting traps in the newly established reef area. The program is funded with $300,000 received through a settlement from the World Prodigy oil spill that occurred in 1989. Some 290,000 gallons polluted Narragansett Bay, killing about 70,000 lobsters. But an oil spill that occurred a few years ago near Narragansett Bay had more severe effects on the lobster industry. According to John Katina, restoration coordinator for NOAA's Restoration Center based in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
It was off the southern coast of Rhode Island, and it was, just for comparison purposes, it was a much larger spill and had much more severe impacts. In fact, we've estimated some 9 million lobsters were killed. That particular spill, which was called the North Cape oil spill, the North Cape was the name of the barge that ran aground.
Katina says negotiations towards a settlement are ongoing with those responsible for the North Cape spill. Many of the lobsters killed by that spill were juveniles, which affected the size of the next generation. Katina says some lobstermen are complaining of low hauls and blame it on the spills. He says while oil spills have hurt lobster populations in and around Rhode Island's Narragansett Bay, there is no question overfishing is putting pressure on the species in this state and elsewhere.
And whatever we are able to do with augmenting the population through a hatchery or creating more lobster habitat is really only going to be a drop in the bucket in terms of the overall population looking at it coastwide. You know, we're trying to have an impact on a pretty site-specific level and in a small geographic area. So clearly the management of the resource coastwide is really the crux of the problem that has to be addressed.
Researchers hope this restoration project, combined with tougher limits on lobster hauls, will produce an industry that continues to bring in millions of dollars to the small state, but more importantly, produces one that is sustainable. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. This month, March 24 to be exact, marks the 10th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. And you'll recall that just after midnight of that day, a vessel, the Exxon Valdez, ran aground. A hole was torn in the bottom of the vessel, and 11.2 million gallons of crude oil leaked into the water. And that created an environmental disaster. Wildlife losses at the time were estimated to include about 5,000 sea otters, 300 harbor seals, 22 killer whales, 150 bald eagles, something in the order of 250,000 water birds, as well as salmon and fish. So the question now is, what has happened since then, and what is being done and has been done to see that similar events do not occur? With me are two people who have been very close to this. With me is Michelle Brown, and she is Commissioner of Environmental Conservation for the state of Alaska. And she joins us from the capital of Alaska in Juneau. Also with us is John Devins, and he is Regional Director of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. But he was also Mayor of Valdez when the spill occurred. And the Advisory Council is a nonprofit group that was started after the spill, and his mission is to prevent spills from occurring in the future. So, Michelle, welcome to the Environment Show.
Thank you. I feel
a certain affinity for you since I was an Environmental Conservation Commissioner in my state of New York many years ago. Tell us what your evaluation is of the health of the ecosystem now. How well has it recovered?
Well, it's recovered in part, but we still have a long way to go. I think the most telling statistic is that you rattled off some of the casualties, and there were 28 species of resources that were impacted by the spill. And since the spill, only two have been declared recovered. The rest are either recovery is unknown, they are not recovering, or they are recovering but slowly.
Wow, that is really something, since, of course, we see things from the oil company that would make you think life is just fine all over again.
It takes a long time for recovery to take place. And I'd say overall ecological recovery is uncertain, and there are still some beaches where you can see oil. But the only species that have actually been declared recovered are bald eagle and river otter.
Well, I went up during the course of the spill in my capacity as head of Audubon, and I remember that beaches that were allegedly cleaned up, the tide would come up and the stuff would come right back up again. In fact, I remember one particular beach that Dan Quayle, then vice president, was supposed to visit, and they got it three times before they could have clean sand for him to go look at. Is that still occurring? Do you find that at periods of high water that oil is still coming up from odd places?
There are places where that happens, and there are places where you won't see it during tides, but if you dig deep enough, you can encounter pockets of oil.
And before we leave this subject, how long is that anticipated to go on? Is there any sense that this may come to an end at some point?
We don't really know. We know eventually it will dissipate, but it's going to still take a considerable amount of time.
Now, John Devins, your group was put together to see that this kind of thing wouldn't happen in the future. In fact, you've produced a lot of materials that I've seen that talk about precautionary action. What kind of shape are we in? If there were another Exxon Valdez, would response be faster, or is there less likelihood that it might happen?
Well, there's certainly less likelihood that another Exxon Valdez won't happen, but any system devised by man can also be fouled by man. We did a risk assessment recently. In fact, it was just completed about a year ago, and that suggests that a spill such as the Exxon Valdez, the likelihood of that has been reduced by about 70%. But our biggest concern is complacency. That's what was happening back in 89. We'd gone 10 years without a spill of any real significance, and we'd all grown a little complacent.
Well, when you say the likelihood is only 70% or is reduced 70%, what has happened that reduces the likelihood since it occurred in 89?
Well, the system is much more redundant today in terms of having more escort vessels, more eyes on it. In 89, budget cuts for the Coast Guard had reduced their monitoring of the tankers. Today, the tankers are monitored. The pilot stays with the tanker longer. We have escort vessels that go with the tanker. I can't imagine the same spill occurring again, but quite frankly, in 89, we were all amazed that someone would drive the newest and probably the best tanker in the fleet up on a rock in a channel that was 10 miles wide.
That, of course, is the human issue, which is always there. But one of the things that I remember, John, was talking at the time to a state official that had some kind of monitoring responsibility for the terminal, the place where oil was being loaded into the tankers. And I remember him telling me on the site that he was not allowed into the premises unless they gave advance warning. And he was very critical about that, since he felt that the oil guys were getting away with murder. Is the inspection system, and I think both of you probably have some comments on this, better now than it was then?
Well, and probably Michelle is better capable of responding to that than I am, but certainly it is. Even my group, I have 15 people that work for me, and we're badged so that we can go on the terminal site at any time. And I assume that Michelle's people can do that also.
That's correct. We have enormously increased staff since 89, as does the Joint Pipeline Office. And we are also badged to go on and conduct inspections as necessary. We also are putting a lot more effort into drills, and hope to do even more of that in the future, so that we are constantly exercising our discretion in how to act in various scenarios, and really practice together with industry, with the Coast Guard, and make sure that when we encounter another situation, we're not going to all be shocked and essentially paralyzed in our response, because it is a new situation.
Can you keep the kind of readiness that you need, though, given the fact that it may be a decade or so between disasters? Can you keep the intensity up that's needed to keep monitoring the sites and keep pushing people on the drills?
Well, we've put in place ways to make sure we do that, one of which is John's group, because they are constantly monitoring both industry and government. And that's what I think John was talking about when he was mentioning the redundancies, is we are constantly in this cycle of challenging all of our respective staffs with continuous improvement. And keeping focused on drills rather than just writing contingency plans, I think will even further keep eyes and ears focused on making sure that we don't forget.
Now, John, your folk are largely volunteers, are they, or how does your system work?
Well, I have 15 paid staff that work for me, but we have a board of 19 that represent the communities that were oiled in 89, as well as some environmental groups and fisheries groups and native communities.
I'd like to move to another piece of this. Exxon has been told, or they've had to put up, I think it's $900 million for various forms of damages and so on. Michelle, in terms of the recovery and habitat protection, how is that going, and what are the big challenges that you face in the future?
Well, the Trustee Council, which administers the $900 million in the civil settlement, has done both research and habitat acquisition. And with the money that's been spent so far, more than 280 salmon streams and vital old-growth forests that are necessary for nesting marine birds and about 1,400 miles of shoreline have been acquired so that these areas will be protected and make sure that they are restored. The remainder of the money has gone into research, and the challenge on us now is to make sure we synthesize that research in a way that resource managers can use it and make sure that they're making the best decisions for the health of the ecosystem, and that we as spill responders have access to that information so that when we make immediate spill response decisions, we're targeting the most critical resource and making sure that we're protecting that resource.
John, I noticed in a recent article with the National Geographic that there have been 50 Exxon Valdez-sized spills in the last 30 years. I don't know how many in the last 10 years, but apparently these things just keep on going. One of the things that was recommended at the end of the Valdez situation, and the Congress legislated double hulls on tankers, meaning they had to have basically two shells, so if one broke, the oil wouldn't get out. Where are we on that, and why hasn't that moved more rapidly?
Well, it is, it's on course. Actually, ARCO has announced that they're building three what they call Millennium-class tankers, which are double-hull tankers, state-of-the-art tankers. Some of the other companies have been a little more reticent about getting started, and we always worry that someone will try to amend the Oil Pollution Act of 90 and look for alternative ways of shipping oil other than using double-hull tankers.
Well, now, before we leave that, though, isn't that a real threat that the oil lobby, the less responsible folk, are working hard to repeal the double-shell, the double-hull tanker rule?
We understand that that is the case, and hopefully we will have a Congress that will stand firm on it.
So I guess the message to all of us is taxpayers is to push our Congress people to see that that environmental protection stays intact.
It's a very, very important part of the prevention cycle in terms of shipping this oil.
One factor in there that's interesting is that nearly 60% of the current Trans-Alaska pipeline fleet is either double-hull or double-bottom tankers right now. And one of the arguments we've been using against changing the standard is that it's economically unfair for the companies that are indeed already investing in double hulls and double bottoms. If the standard is rolled back, then these companies are put in an unfair economic position.
I've got to say, just as a citizen, I'm outraged that having had this this rule put in place, presumably to protect all of us, that they're now trying to back off it. Let me ask you both something on a separate subject, and that has to do with where we go from here. With respect to recovery and habitat protection, Michelle, what is next on the agenda?
Next is on the agenda is actually developing the research program that I mentioned earlier and getting a handle on all the science that's been done so that we can make sure that we're making the best management decisions based on that data in the future.
And all of these species that you've indicated that have not recovered, is there anything more that can be done for them, or is it just a hope that Mother Nature will pull them through somehow?
So far, we don't know what else can be done other than acquiring critical habitat to make sure that it is not further degraded. But we are going to continue to monitor those species so that we can track how long it does take before recovery happens.
And are there other land purchases either in the pipeline or planned so that indeed more habitat is protected?
$55 million has been set aside to create a long-term land acquisition program, both large parcel and small parcel.
And I hope that for people who can't see that countryside, this is one of the most beautiful areas in the world, with these great forests coming down to the sea and the ice and the green trees and the blue water. There's just nothing like it. Now, with respect to the prevention situation, John, what is first on your priority list for things that have to get done next?
Well, we stay very much on top, and we have extremely good support from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, in terms of insisting that industry use the best available technology. You probably have read where they have just built two new tractor tugs, extremely large tugs to work in the system, and these are state-of-the-art. They're about to put on three more tugs in the near future that are called Z-drive tugs. But keeping the emphasis on prevention, we know that once the oil is in the water, even under the best circumstances, it's a pathetically small amount or percentage of the oil that's picked up.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to wind up at that. We've been talking about the Valdez oil spill on the occasion of its 10th anniversary. My guests have been Michelle Brown, she's Commissioner of Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation, and John Devins, who is Executive Director of the Prince William Sound Citizens Advisory Council. And they are both based in Alaska. We'd like to hear your thoughts about the Valdez spill, what could be done to prevent these things elsewhere, and the hazards of transporting oil by sea in general. So give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. We'd like to hear from you. Drop us a note. The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green at wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author David Quammen, it's Los Angeles, where a quick cab ride will help you find a secretive, poodle-eating coyote. In this portrait of place, Quammen reads from his book titled Wild Thoughts from Wild Places.
The cab driver's name is Amir. He's a young Israeli. He lives in Sherman Oaks, just over the so-called Santa Monica Mountains from Beverly Hills. He meets me at my hotel on Wilshire Boulevard, and for a moment we confer over destination and routing. Yes, yes, says Amir. He believes he can find Burbank, no problem. He is a professional with a professional map. So we drive off along the rain-slick Los Angeles freeways. At 5:30 on this winter morning, it's still dark, but the roads are already astream with traffic, and I'm happy to let Amir prove his professionalism versus the ramps and the merging lanes and the welter of split-second choices while I concentrate on my coffee. Thank heaven for taxis. If I were driving, I'd commit that single wrong move and wind up gridlocked on the far side of Long Beach at mid-morning, whereas it's crucial to reach Wildwood Canyon Park before dawn. You are doing what? Says Amir. Going to look for coyotes, I tell him. There are no coyotes in Tel Aviv, just one thing among many that distinguish Amir's home city from Los Angeles. There are no coyotes in Israel whatsoever. The world's most cunning and adaptable species of canid is strictly a creature of the Americas. But Amir is a quick study, and when I repeat the word, it registers. Coyote, he says. Ah, like a dog, yes? That's the one, I say. Like a dog, only it's a wild animal. Amir is amused. He appreciates this departure from cab driverly routine. Most of his early morning fares are not gentlemen headed out to slog in the hills above Burbank in search of coyotes, he informs me. A silent ride to the airport is rather more common. While Amir talks, I gape out the window toward Studio City, noticing that the drizzle has gotten heavier. Then we make our appointed crossover from the Ventura Freeway to the Golden State Freeway, swinging back toward the northwest, and Amir adds, I don't know these people in the city if they know that they have coyotes. No doubt he's more right than wrong. Coyotes are adept, when they want to be, at remaining invisible. Within the Los Angeles basin, they're obliged to choose their home territories and their travel corridors with care, finding security in the large patches and linear strips of greenery preserved as parks and wisps of landscaping, or in the topographic anomalies too steep and too fashionable to be buried completely by pavement. Patches like Griffith Park, linear strips like Mulholland Drive, topographic anomalies like Laurel Canyon. And those L.A. coyotes that remain innocent of garbage scarfing and poodle disembowelment, plus the ones that are just too smart to be trapped for their sins, can continue to thrive within the slightly less fashionable patches of urban greenery, such as Wildwood Canyon Park. Amir drops me off at the park gate with a promise to return in 4 hours. The gate is barricaded to traffic. A sign says, Park closed, adding in large letters that violators will be subject to arrest or citation, so I glance around carefully before ignoring it.
That was author David Quammen reading from his book titled Wild Thoughts from Wild Places. It's published by Scribner. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If the coyotes get sick from PCBs they got eating dolphins, is there enough of that exploding star in their bloodstream to save them? Find out by ordering a copy of the tape. 1-800-323-9262. Ask for show number 480. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com.
www.theenvironmentshow.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.